and welcome back to another episode of The Co-op, the official podcast of the New Pro-Life Movement. This is your co-host, Rebecca Bratton-Weiss, here with Matthew Tyson.
Hello.
Matthew, how are you?
I'm good. I'm real good. The weather in Alabama has shifted all the way back over towards spring. So last week we had literal snow on the ground and 4 degree temperatures, and this week it's been sunny and in the 60s. So it's been nice. It's been a nice change of pace.
Yeah, well, we had some of that here too. So I was out trying to catch up on all of my garden work.
Yeah.
Gardening in mid-January is kind of a treat if you live in the Midwest.
Sure.
So that was nice. The weather was nice. Other things not so nice.
Yeah.
I don't know. After losing my job, I was really thrilled to be able to step away from this like little toxic bubble of right wing oddballs. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've had the joy of working with Revolution of Tenderness, where it's all like art and activism and connecting people and festivals of friendship and publishing poems, and that's all very, it's just wholesome and beautiful. And then today I was reminded of what my life used to be like. because it came to my attention that I guess she's a blogger. I've never really engaged with her.
Books, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, like
she writes books.
Yeah, she has a handful of books out. I guess
Twilight was published, so anything's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her name's Lila Miller, and she's like gotten on our case before. As far as I was concerned, it was just this random person coming out of the blue asking kind of passive aggressive, obnoxious questions. And someone had screenshotted a statement that I made about the March for Life and shared it with her, and they were taking it out of context. And my basic statement was that you can't compare the suffering and the oppression of the unborn to the suffering and oppression of, say, African Americans or the Jews in the Holocaust, because there you have a very clear case where you've got this powerful demographic oppressing, deliberately oppressing, a disenfranchised demographic. And abortion, as we've said repeatedly, is very different from that. It's the case of women who are desperate and in dire circumstances making this kind of like last-ditch effort to keep their lives together. And so I basically just said, you know, women aren't, the unborn aren't oppressed because of a powerful demographic. And then I went on to talk after that. It was like a Facebook comment. It was not like me at my pro stylist best. did you see that whole thing too?
I mean,
it was kind of a cluster cuss.
I did. And I don't know. I was, I don't want to say I was like really taken aback by it, but I was just kind of confused that, the insistence to misrepresent kind of like our stances on the issues.
Right.
And I know that it's in the face of, you know, the modern pro-life thought, it is kind of a hard concept to wrap your head around. I totally get that. I mean, and I understand that for some people it's difficult, but at the same time, to try and blatantly state the case as openly and as honestly and as transparently as you possibly can, and then to just have someone just like continue to, I guess, just completely ignore that, like just completely ignore any kind of explanation or completely refuse to read into anything, to consider any context, consider any kind of conversation or anything of the sort. It's frustrating. But it's also ridiculous. And to me, it's a good representation of the kind of thinking and the kind of refusal to acknowledge that there might be a different way to look at things, refusal to acknowledge, the other side of the story, the perception of the women who are in, these desperate situations, this sort of this all out refusal to, look outside of anything, but this just incredibly subjective, narrow worldview. And that is part of the reason why we exist in the first place. It's sort of what we put ourselves together to fight against.
Yeah, and they kept trying to like do this, I guess they're attempting to play at a Socratic dialogue and try to get me to answer questions, which is kind of the same thing that Church Militant was doing on mm-hmm. Twitter earlier. And I just want to say this. I don't respond to bullying questions from people who are clearly not in good faith and possibly have difficulty reading basic English, because I don't think that this is a conversation out of which any good can come. If anyone wants to know what I think, I have a blog. If anyone wants to know what you think, you have written in numerous places, and the statements from the new pro-life movement are readily available to anyone who knows mm-hmm. how to click on a keyboard. So, you know, I will happily talk to people on both sides of the aisle if they approach me in good faith. But I'm not responding to bullies because I know that they'll take what we say out of context anyway.
Well, yeah,
and just kind of drag us down through the dirt.
It's on purpose because when you offer any kind of a challenging worldview, I mean, if you offer any kind of a challenge to an established worldview, like with the pro-life movement, and people who, you know, can't wrap their heads around it, or who just do not want to even for a second consider that they might be wrong. And this is for anything. I mean, this really goes for anything. I mean, the easiest thing for you to do is to just, you know, objectify that person and just immediately turn them into the bad guy, to immediately write the stuff off as evil or, you know, deceitful or, you know, a liberal attempt to sneak in and, you know, disrupt the pro-life movement or whatever. And it's because the kind of stuff that we talk about and then the kind of stuff that we've heard from multiple people who have, you know, reached out to us and who have followed us and who have responded to all the blogs and things that we've written, is that, you know, this kind of sentiment is kind of growing, and they're afraid. I think these people are afraid that they're going to kind of lose their seat of power. You know, I mean, not so much power, but, you know, any kind of modicum of influence they've got in this, you know, this traditional pro-life movement. And that's just a common
problem.
Tactic, you know, it's just a common tactic to just immediately turn it around on you and try to turn you into the bad guy, instead of actually trying to have a dialogue about, hey, you know, maybe there's a different way to look at this. Maybe there's a way that some people can kind of come together and work things out. It's almost like I think we've talked before about people lacking the ability to compromise, mm-hmm. or even for a second think that maybe, you know, there's just a different way to do this, you know, and that's all it is. And I think that concept is terrifying to people. I mean, it really is.
Right.
It's terrifying to people.
Yeah. And I think it is associated with you start, I don't know, I guess developing a brand, which I think is a very dangerous thing to do in general. If you're an artist, if you're a thinker, you can't develop a brand because you have to remain engaged with reality and be challenged by reality. And, you know, that's why it's great to be kind of a free range thinker, because you're not tethered to any body, any authority that's going to tell you that you have to keep, you know, towing a certain line. But that is especially dangerous when it comes to activism, because the whole point of being pro-life has nothing to do with promoting our brand and our slogans. You know, if it turns out that, like, the new pro-life approach needs to be tweaked this way or that, then we'll tweak it if we can see clearly that it needs to change.
Right.
I'm not personally invested in maintaining slogans. If a slogan is bad, then I will move on from it. So, and then again, it becomes so much about just opposing the opposition. Like, why these people seem really concerned with beating liberals, beating feminists, beating pro-choicers, instead of with taking care of human lives. And since at no point have we said, oh, we don't care about human lives, I don't understand why. Well, I do understand why they're attacking us.
Yeah.
And it's partially because we attacked them first. I mean, not there in person,
mm-hmm.
not ad hominem, but we criticized their ideas. So
yeah.
I guess we... You know, we should have seen it coming.
She did message us. When we first started, we did get messages from a lot of people in and around that bubble who asked those very, very obviously, like, subjective questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been interesting. But I mean, we knew, and it's something that you know you deal with, and we're always going to deal with. And it's like I was saying earlier today. You know, there's a group of people when you do this, you know, stuff like this. There's a group of people that you are going to have to reach out to and try to work with, and then at some point or another, you're going to run into a group of people that you're going to have to either completely ignore or fight. I mean, that's just kind of the reality of any kind of social justice movement. There's always going to be somebody to fight. And you want to avoid it and you don't want to, but there's some people out there that can't, you know, they can't wrap your head around what they're saying and they can't accept it. And, right. And there's, you know, it's better for you to move on and keep pressing forward and just, and refuse that and resist that, you know, it's a part of this concept of resistance in the first place. So, speaking of yeah. resistances, there was a lot of activism the past couple of weeks. We are recording this just a few days after the Women's March and the March for Life took place, correct? And it was the March for Life. I understand. Look, let me say this. I understand. I get the fact that it's kind of weird for some people who are maybe on the fence about how we feel, to go, well, maybe are they really pro-life, to hear us bash, like, you know, every staple of the pro-life movement, known to man. But to be fair, that is kind of the point of why we exist in the first place. It truly kind of is.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's not all negative for the sake of being negative, I promise. But the March for Life this year was very disappointing to me. And to me, it's been, you know, I mean, for anyone that you know, kind of approaches the pro-life ideology the way they do, it's always going to be a little bit disappointing because it's dominated by the kind of thinking that we reject. But, you know, this time around, they had the, I believe it was Paul Ryan was a speaker, and then Donald Trump addressed the March for Life from the White House. And just real quick, am I wrong? Like, is it not true that, like, Bush and Reagan addressed the March for Life, like, from video or whatever? Like, I mean, I get that it wasn't,
they phoned in. They didn't have Skype back then, you know.
But they addressed it. And I mean, he was like
they used
at the White
technology
House.
That was available.
He couldn't, he couldn't ride down the street to, like...
I mean, he has probably his golf cart, so, yeah, you know, what can I say?
But, you know, Trump was a speaker there, and we've said blatantly before that Trump is not pro-life. Trump is, the fact that the pro-life movement tied itself to Trump was the biggest mistake he could have possibly done, because the guy is not pro-life. He does not embody, I mean, even if you're wary about the whole life approach, it's not that hard to say that he's not in it. Because he believes in it, he's not, and so it was frustrating. And then, of course, it contrasted pretty strongly in you know, social media and regular media with the Women's March.
Yeah, and I know people who went to both, which, you know, in an ideal world, a lot of people would do. Because these two things are so connected. You know, and I would like to go to the March for Life and to the Women's March. One reason I don't go is because of expense.
Sure.
And I feel that on a limited budget, it might be wiser to think about spending that money donating to organizations that help women and babies, which is what we encouraged people to do last year. But this year, even if I could afford it, even if I'd wanted to go to DC, I wouldn't have gone because of the Trump and Ryan presence. I feel like you said, even many people who are fairly conservative, just kind of, you know, traditional moral thinkers, can see blatantly that Trump is not pro-life. But add to that how radically sexist and misogynistic he is. As soon as he's associated with the pro-life movement, it's like putting up a huge banner that says, no, we actually do not care about women.
Right.
They keep saying they do, but, you know, actions speak louder than words.
I mean, you've got a guy who, you had the Access Hollywood tapes before. You got all this stuff right. with the porn star, and then the things he's written in his books and things he's said. I mean, there's no mistaking that the guy is a sexist. And of course, we've talked before about how he's a racist. And so, like you, yeah, exactly, yep. like you said, they're tying themselves to Trump. They're selling out for what they're hoping is going to be their win. But in doing so, I mean, what else are you losing? That was the thing that killed me the most, and the thing that really struck me when I was when we were going through the election. You had all these pro-life voices, even some that you would be surprised at coming out in support of Trump. And
that was so weird.
And the entire time, my thought process was like, I understand what you're hoping to gain. I truly, honestly, can sympathize with where you're hoping you can gain. I get that, because for a lot of people, it felt like they were compromising, and I appreciate the concept of compromise. Mm-hmm. I truly do, but. Part of entering to his compromise is discerning, you know, what that's going to mean for you, like what you're going to take on as part of that compromise. And for like pro-life movement, part of that compromise was taking on all of the baggage that Trump brings with it, and all of the baggage that Roy Moore brings with it, and all of the baggage that that all of these horrible people you're bringing on all these horrible things onto you. And so any hope, any chance that you ever wanted of trying to reach especially trying to reach people that you need to reach the most, the people that need to hear the pro-life right. message the most, who need to hear these things, you know, not the people that are just going to repeat it, but the people that we're supposed to be converting, like, you're damaging that witness. And I can understand completely and totally how you could make that exact same argument for some Democrats. But the problem is that Democratic policies and whether, no matter how you feel about them, by and large, these Democratic policies aim more towards helping these women instead of punishing them or hurting them. And their demeanor and their attitude and the way they approach the entire situation is one that is much more sympathetic and empathetic. And so you would think that just looking at the situation, you know, the pro-life movement at least could say, hey, maybe this is probably not the guy we need to tie ourselves to, you know. Yeah. I understand being so obsessed with a goal that it blinds you a little bit, but that severe lack of foresight is insane to me. I mean, it really truly is.
Yeah, and I feel like it kind of disqualifies people from leadership, because if you can't think politically in terms of causes and effects and probable outcomes, if you can't think about the role of rhetoric, the classical branches of rhetoric,
sure.
and how this kind of reverberates through the culture, if you can't think in terms of marketing and PR mm-hmm. And human psychology, then you might be a really nice person, but you shouldn't be leading a major political movement that deals with serious life issues.
Right.
So, like, I mean, I get that people were willing to make the compromise, but I have trouble fathoming how people who aren't, you know, practically village idiots couldn't see the obvious outcome of this, which is that the pro-choice feminists are going to become more and more adamantly opposed to anything with the label pro-life on it. Mm-hmm. Very suspicious. You're going to have more of these cases where, even if you're a consistent life pro-life feminist, they don't want to talk to you, because all they've ever seen are people marching with signs that say abortion kills and mm-hmm. pictures of horribly mangled aborted babies, and this is what they associate with us. So when we say things like, you know, we understand that women aren't making this choice because they want to commit violence, mm-hmm. they aren't making this choice in a moral vacuum, I feel like we're saying something that women will stop and listen to. They're like, oh, okay, fine, you're talking about my experience. So
exactly.
Yeah, I guess I can be patient to some extent with the intentions, but I'm having trouble being patient with the stupidity.
Well, it's like we've said before, you know, if you this movement really can't go forward unless it is willing to understand the other perspective. Because when you're anti-abortion, I understand the struggle. When you're pro-life, you it's hard for you to understand how people can't see it. You know, it's hard for you to understand like how someone mm-hmm. couldn't see it as just this horrible evil. And I understand that struggle, but you've got to. I mean, that's the thing is you've got right. to get over that. You've got to. I mean, there's just no way to put it right. You're just going to have to get over that. You're going to have to learn that there are people out there that legitimately, a lot of people out there that do not see this with the same lens as you. And if you really want to do something about the issue, then you have to learn to see it from their perspective. Until you learn to see things from the other side of this, you simply are not going to move forward. I mean, of course, that's true for everything, but especially yep. true for this, because it is such a personal, yep. Serious issue. And that's the problem with a lot of the old pro-life movement. And again, especially by tying themselves to Trump, is that you're just further refusing to even listen to what these people have to say, to understand their perspective, understand where they're coming from. I mean, for Christ's sakes, the majority of women who get abortions in the first place are Christians. Like, right. it's not like, I mean, there's something else that should tell you something. That should really tell you something. I mean, honest to God. Mm-hmm. I mean, heck, like talk about last week, the fact that people are willing to put their anti-abortion stuff aside to vote for someone like Doug Jones over Roy Moore mm-hmm. tells you something. And right. if you want to do something about abortion, you've got to listen to that kind of stuff. You've got to pay attention to those kind of things. You've got to learn to see things from that kind of perspective, because that's all very, very important into rooting out these injustices that are causing abortion in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that means, like, a lot of the popular old comparisons, unfortunately, are not effective, like comparing abortion to slavery and comparing the pro-life march to civil rights activists. You know, I get that there's an overlap there. You sure. say, well, here is an injustice being done to a vulnerable demographic. We must stand against it. But the reasons behind it are so different. And I also think, you know, going back to what you said about how they view it differently, they're not viewing it differently because of moral blindness.
Right.
I think that you have to be, like, if you're a slave owner and there is a woman being separated from her baby, weeping and begging, please don't sell my baby. If there's a man being beaten and saying, you know, please don't do this to me, please don't do this to me, to keep on doing that is the work of a moral monster, because you see a human being right in front of your eyes and you choose to ignore it. With the unborn child, not only do you not see it, but, you know, for the first trimester, it just kind of looks like a little wiggly tadpole. And, you know, I don't think people are denying that it's human or that it's alive. They're just saying it hasn't yet reached the point at which we owe it the full concern given to a born baby.
Right.
It's kind of, yeah, you're thinking of it more the way you would think of an animal. And so you can't accuse women who are making this choice of being like slave owners and having it really obviously in their face that this is a human person and choosing to do this anyway. I mean, look at in the history of kind of more archaic biology, there was all kinds of debating as to whether it was the fetus was actually a person. Thomas Aquinas, although he was opposed to abortion, it wasn't because he thought that the unborn child was a human being yet in the first trimester. It had to do with, like, going against God's design. And he also thought that male fetuses became persons earlier than female fetuses. Thanks, Aquinas.
for me, it's a philosophical thing. I mean, for me, I have this moral and ethical philosophical belief that you know, life in the womb is human and it is worthy of protection, that we shouldn't be aborting them. I have this belief about that.
Right.
And I share that belief with a lot of people. But again, you also have to understand, like Rebecca said, you have to understand where the other, like how, you have to understand the legitimacy that the other side has when it comes to this belief, because you have to, if they don't hold that, like you said, if you're looking at, if you're, you know, relying on perception of things, then yes, it is very different. I mean, we have to be honest about the fact that there is a different perception there. And yes, you can, the first time that I saw that little tadpole, you know, in my wife's stomach, I was like, yes, that's absolutely, you know, my kid, I'm stoked, that's a human being, I get it, because I hold that perception. And I'm not saying that my perception
right.
is wrong or subjective. I think my perception is absolutely right, don't get me wrong, like
yeah.
I am pro-life
yeah.
for a reason. I am convinced that I am right on this subject, and that there is a, you know, no matter how legitimate a philosophical argument you can make, I still think it's wrong to have an abortion. But that doesn't really matter in the reality of things.
Right.
That drives my fuel to do something about the abortion issue, but how I feel about it doesn't really honestly matter. It's not that I believe that my morality is necessarily subjective. It's that it doesn't really, I don't think it really plays into the situation at all, because the reality is completely different. And so if you're going to find a solution to a problem in the reality, then you have to work with the reality that you have. And I think that's just...
Yeah.
It's not a very difficult concept, in my opinion. I don't.
No. No. And yeah, and I agree with you. In traditional ethics, you make a distinction between the objective morality of the act, objective harm done to an actual objective good, and then on the other hand, there's personal culpability. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in Catholic moral principles, this is like Catholic moral principles 101.
Yeah.
That that knowledge and will need to come into it if you're evaluating a mortal sin, and this is the case for any kind of sin. If you don't know, and if not, it's not fully intentional, then it's not held against you. And I feel like there are many, many situations where women don't know. And not necessarily even because they're ignorant. They're just making a kind of decision based on the evidence that's available, and their mm-hmm. decision is different from mine. And then there's other cases where they don't really have a choice. You're envisioning, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have this baby. I'm going to lose my job. Oh, I don't have health care. I don't have money to pay for my children. I live in a hovel. What am I going to do? Well, in those cases, I think these are the women who make it a desperate decision to do something they never wanted to do.
Right.
And then people are like, oh, well, they have a choice not to have sex. No.
That's never worked.
Actually, that's kind of what we've been talking about with this whole like sexual assault thing. And it's not just assault, it's coercion. It's a whole power structure that exists in male-female sexuality, which is something I've been writing about on my blog, how there are all these situations where, well, it wasn't exactly rape, but I didn't really feel like I had free choice either.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we can say abortion is wrong without saying that as a condemnation of women.
Well, even if you take all that stuff out, you're still not going to be successful in stopping people from having sex in the first place.
Right.
We've never been able to achieve that, and it's not going to happen.
No.
Like, that's another situation of accepting the reality of what we're working with. Now, I want to close on this because this is, and I want to get Rebecca your opinion on this, because this is kind of related to what you're just saying. But I think one of the biggest failings of the pro-life movement, I've ever expressly put this into words, but we've certainly talked around it, but in regards to talking about seeing things from the someone else's perspective, especially these desperate women, I think one of the biggest failings within the pro-life movement is that all of the arguments have this undercurrent of guilt and blame and shame and absolute mm-hmm. culpability thrown onto the mother.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and this is a very important one. You know, like you said, we talked about culpability and earlier, but you're essentially, no matter what the issue is, there is always this undercurrent of, you know, I'm telling you, pregnant mother, what you need to do, but just know that I think you're, you know, a bad person, an awful human being, a criminal, you know, mm. Your foundation is based in making the woman the bad guy in the first place. You're not going to have a lot of luck, as a movement.
Right.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that a little bit and kind of get your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of happens on two levels. First of all, there's like the whole slut-shaming thing, you know.
Right.
Invariably, there will be the one person who says, well, women can just keep their legs shut. Well, if we just had chastity, this wouldn't happen. You know, which is kind of ironic when you've got all of these situations, you know, in conservative institutions where it's coming out that powerful conservative religious leaders have been sexual predators, and then people representing these same institutions to be lecturing women on chastity.
Right.
Just shut up, guys.
Right.
So that's the first level. But then the second is the whole language of abortion is murder, abortion is a crime. And whenever someone says that, I say, oh, so you think women should be put in jail for having abortions? And then they get kind of uncomfortable because that's not a popular thing to say, but a lot of them will still say it. They'll still say it. But, you know, these women are making a violent choice, an oppressive choice. So, like, and what if you run away from that person and you do have an abortion? And what if afterwards you regret it? What if you're looking for someone to help you in your next pregnancy if you decided you want to choose life? You're not going to go back to those people.
No.
In fact, just about every pro-choice feminist I know, including the ones I know who have worked at Planned Parenthood, would be a better person to go to. Yeah, I said that.
Is that right? Yeah, so this has been a good episode, I think. I had fun. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been good. All right, we'll see you then. Take.